I'm Josh, and welcome to Two Commas, the podcast where we talk about exits, particularly with founders who've taken a business from often inception all the way through to a seven-figure plus exit. Today, I'm really excited to have join me on the show Hugh Carvely. Hugh is the co-founder and CEO of Moxion, deep in the entertainment space, and had a real impact taking New Zealand technology in the entertainment movie business to Hollywood and then on to a successful exit. Hugh, thanks very much for joining me on the show today. I'm really grateful to have you here. And perhaps, as always, we could start the show with a bit of a backstory and a bit of a hi.
Yeah, of course. Pleasure to be here. And I've known you for a while now. Actually, I just completely forgot. I like the look of trepidation you have, but I have something for you.
Amazing.
There we go.
A pair of Moxion socks.
Yes.
To put some context around these beautiful stripy numbers, Hugh and I caught up just recently, about a month ago, and we're talking about what might exist still of Moxion, and you said the socks are still around, and I said I love stripy socks, and so now I've got my own pair.
You have.
And thank you, brother.
I think that might be the last pair in existence. So.
Oh, treasure them.
Yeah.
You'll never see them on Trade Me, never.
They're called the Mox Socks, so that was part of a marketing exercise we did before we were acquired. Yeah, so I come from like fairly humble beginnings. I think I didn't grow up in an entrepreneurial space. My parents were fairly hardworking, and bless them, but they didn't have an entrepreneurial bone in their body. And this was out in QMU in the late 70s and the early 80s, and it was a great time to grow up because change was afoot, and computers were first starting to come in, and movies were just starting to reap the benefits of computers in terms of visual effects. So back then, I think the two things that I remember are seeing my first computer, which was an Apple IIe, and seeing Star Wars.
Yeah,
wow. And you always remember the first time you see Star Wars, right, if you're of my generation.
And those are two fairly iconic bits of the entirety of certainly my living history, you know, Star Wars release and then the Apple IIe computer as well, you know, phenomenal, both of them.
Yeah. So they, I think, just wedged their way into my subconscious, and here I am, you know, many years later in the movie industry with a startup that was primarily around SaaS and computers.
Mm.
So,
and that wasn't your first startup, Moxion. You had something earlier on than that. Could you give us a bit of insight into what your first venture was?
Yeah, so it was called RoboForge, and it was in the early 2000s, and we came up with an idea. There were three of us, and then later five of us, to build a robot fighting game. Darren Green, the guy who was... I think he had the main idea. He had seen this Japanese robot fighting game, and then also I think there was BattleBots, and we thought we're going to try and do a computer graphic version of that. So it was pretty successful in terms of the product. You could build these robots, and we had our own physics engine. But unfortunately, we had just got to the US. We got a great review at a PC Gamer. And we were going around trying to sell it. And the first company we demoed to was Sony. They were interested. They made us a deal. We had another, I think, eight companies to go see. And we thought, wow, we got a deal from the first people that we saw. Let's keep going. But unfortunately, the dot-com crash happened whilst we were still traveling around the US. So all the funding was pulled out. And we went our merry way elsewhere.
With some experiences, what do they say? You either win or you learn.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. From there, I ended up working as a computing programming contractor for hire in the UK. Then I ended up in Brunei and Singapore. And I was working in Singapore. I had a good friend who was a trade commissioner up there, and I was meeting a lot of these New Zealand companies wanting to come up to Singapore and expand. And one of them was trying to set up a film school in Singapore. And I got talking to them and was very interested in what they were teaching, and couldn't wait for them to set up in Singapore. So I ended up coming back to New Zealand. And I did my film school here, met my wife, and then I always say I ran away and joined the circus, which is the film industry.
Wow.
And I was lucky enough to be on the film set as the wave of digitization swept over on set. So that wave had already happened with post-production around visual effects, but it had been delayed because they were still shooting on film. And it wasn't until a digital camera, which was the Arri Alexa, came about where it had the quality, or it was good enough to actually start replacing film. And I think if you want to see how you can create a successful startup, you should always look at where there is rapid change for opportunities.
Mm.
And what we were seeing is that people were building these data silos to try and handle this new digital content that was coming from set. And they weren't talking to anyone else. They certainly weren't talking to the cloud. And I just saw an opportunity of getting the data and the metadata that was now being generated in a digital format on set that previously had been analog and into the cloud as fast as we possibly could and make that available for the whole post-production workflow.
Mm. Now, there's a bit of the story that I think you might be missing out here, which is one that is a particular favourite of mine, where you were on your way delivering some film, I understand, to somewhere, and you were covered in fake blood because that was a part of the set that had been going on, and you had a fake cadaver in the car. Can you elaborate and confirm whether or not that story is true?
Of course. Yeah, so there was a movie called 30 Days of Night, which was it was a well-known comic strip, and they were shooting in New Zealand, and it was meant to be set in Alaska, where you truly do get 30 days of night, which is, if you're a vampire, hopefully no spoilers here, is happy times, right? You party for 30 days.
Right.
You don't have to sleep at all.
Mm-hmm.
So we were shooting in New Zealand. It was midwinter, and we had to shoot from, I think, 6 o'clock at night to probably 5 or 6 in the morning. It was grueling. There was rain, there was mud, fake snow. Mm. I think we called it 30 Days of Blight.
Mm.
And this was one of the first sort of big movies I'd been on. So very nervous, wanting to do right. And one of my jobs was making sure that the camera sheets were delivered and that the right metadata was on them. And that's very, very critical, because when you're shooting on film, if you decide to push a film, if you push underexposed it or overexposed it, that information needs to travel with the film, because unless you develop it correctly, you're going to lose information.
Mm.
So I'd already been sort of threatened with dismemberment if I didn't deliver these camera sheets to the right people. And you can probably imagine my horror when at 5 in the morning, someone rocked up to me and said, hey, bro, I forgot to give you this, and the film had already left. So here I am freaking out, driving down the motorway, Northwestern Motorway, trying to catch the runner with the film very, very early in the morning, and my cell phone goes off. So I thought, oh, it must be the runner, right? So I swerved to answer my cell phone, the car, corrected it back, and I caught the attention of the cop who was behind me, who hit his lights and pulled me over. And what had also happened was I had some blood on my face, because we were probably on my entire upper torso, because we were mucking around with some blood squibs and one had gone off too close to me. So I'd worn it. And I hadn't bothered, because I thought, I'm going to go home and have a shower. It's all good. Also in the back of the car was a decapitated dummy, which I'd covered in a sheet because we were shooting a student horror movie, right? Just those kind of movies that you shoot when you come out of film school where you know just enough to make it truly awful, I mean, I like to say that the only victim is the audience in those ones, right?
Mm-hmm. The classic B.
Yeah, and we couldn't get a female dummy. It was meant to be female, so we had a dummy. We called it Steve and slapped a nightie on him and hoped for the best.
Mm-hmm.
So Steve was covered in the back of the car. When I swerved, he had spun out and was lying there resplendent in the back seat. And I just remember the cop coming over to me, and he walked up, he had the light shone on my face and said, "What's that on your face?" And I was just so tired. You know, when you're really tired, you're just very, very honest.
Yes.
And very literal. You know, and I should have said, you know, don't shave in a hurry or something. I don't know, anything. Mm. But I just looked him in the eyes when he asked me what's on my face, and I said, "It's vampire blood." And then I remember him looking over in the back seat, and then he just freaked out. And he just dialed in everybody. So I was sitting there in the car watching my career disappear down the highway in front of me, going, you know what, all this information that's actually on these camera sheets should be available digitally.
Mm.
And it should be able to be captured at the point of record, and we can just put it somewhere up in the cloud, and people can help themselves to it. So I think that probably was the genesis of what later became Moxion. And became this, product which rapidly got the information from set and connected it to the remainder of post-production.
Mm. I love an origin story, and that's one of my favourite in terms of spotting the opportunity for something. So you started to talk about Moxion a little bit there. Could you elaborate a little more in terms of what the start was and then what the ultimate shape and form of the company was when you sold it?
Yeah, of course. So from there, I had to wait a few years because the mechanism wasn't available on the cameras, even when they came out digitally, to deliver the footage. Because what's really important is that you don't get a live stream of the cameras from set. So people were starting to do that already, but it doesn't really work, because unless you know what's been recorded on the cameras, then it's kind of useless.
Mm.
You know, if you see a camera is pointing at someone's foot, well, is that because
context?
Yeah, is that because it's in the shot, or is it because they're not actually filming and the camera person's got a tight shoulder? And it can be dangerous too. So I know one director where they refused to come on set if it was being live streamed, because what he did is he had these very good actors, but they were just not gelling together. So he asked them to shoot a scene, or, you know, rehearse a scene like they were 3-year-old children having a party, and just to get them to relax.
Mm.
Unfortunately, that was a live stream that the studio exec saw and went, "What's he doing with the actors? He's ruining the actors, right?"
Uh-huh.
And so without the context, the stuff, is, not just useless, but it can be dangerous.
Mm.
So what I was waiting for was the ability to know what the camera was recording. So then what we could do is get a proxy of that and send that up into the cloud along with all the accompanying metadata.
Mm-hmm.
Because that metadata can be incredibly useful. Mm-hmm. So, for example, if you're doing a visual effect on that shot, then you need to know the depth of field, right? What's in focus, what's out of focus. And the easiest way to do that as a visual effects artist is to match the lens and things like the ISO. So you can just pop that lens on, and any visual effect you do will match the reality. And if you don't do that, you have to guess.
Mm.
And guessing is expensive, because these guys don't come cheap.
Yes, right.
So we did that. We created the cloud environment, but what we also needed, because we didn't have the funding to do it ourselves, was the ability to save that footage and get it up to the cloud. The part that we really needed was a bit of hardware, which was on almost every single movie set, and it was called Qtake. And that, married with the cloud, the cloud platform we were building, was going to give us this kind of holy grail. And I just needed to sweet talk this guy called Vlado, who was from Slovakia. And in order to do that, I went to Vegas for the first time of my life and met him there. And he was a real character. And I just remember that we spent the entire week figuring out a heads of agreement. And then at the end of that, he said, "Okay, now we drink."
And this is the tiki bar vodka shot story. Yes, okay, got it.
So yes. We ended up at a place called Frankie's Tiki Bar. Mm-hmm. If anyone has been to Vegas,
been to Vegas, but not to that bar.
You should go.
Okay,
yeah,
cool.
Yeah. Doing shots with Lado, and I think I put every second shot in the pot plant behind me, so I survived.
Keep up with them.
It probably didn't.
Yes.
And I just remember that afterwards, he said we should go and have a spa. And so we went to this hotel that was nearby and assumed it was his hotel. And we jumped the fence and had a spa. And then this very large security guard turned up and he had a taser on his belt and said, "You boys better get out of my pool." And we got out and I said to Vlado, "Can I, you know, borrow a towel?" And he said, "I don't know, it's not my hotel, right?" Yeah, and then after that, there was this photo of us in the pool, and I had Michael, my co-founder, doctor a tramp stamp of the Q-Take logo onto us, and we sent that to him and said, "This is a sign of our commitment."
I love it. We've gone and got tattoos after yeah, the tiki yeah. bar and then the random yeah. hotel spa pool. So
that was a really great relationship to have, and it's held firm to this day.
Yeah, yeah. So we met under the guise of Moxion doing a fundraise.
Mm.
And so as an investor, you know, over 50 companies now, I've seen literally hundreds of pitches. It's possibly approaching the four figures rather than three. And so over that time, I've had a lot of people postulate what may happen with their company and where they're going to go with it. Only one experience of all of those is someone had a vision for what may happen, a time frame and a multiple, and that thing has actually, like, almost to the letter come true. So I've got a two-part question for you. I didn't want to steal your thunder.
Mm.
I'm curious if you could share with us what that pitch was, to the best of your recollection.
Yeah.
And then the second bit is how you then went about navigating the journey to make sure that you kind of stayed true to what that original intention was.
Yeah, yeah. So the pitch and I can't take too much credit. I was lucky enough to be in the industry that I was developing the startup in, mm. right?
And you understood the space.
I understood the space. Mm. So the company that ultimately acquired us was Autodesk. And early on, they were a very interesting player in the space. And I'd always admired what they'd done and what they were doing. And I just saw them as a natural partner. Mm-hmm. Of course, it was very aspirational. We hadn't actually done anything with them at that point. But it worked out that when we eventually started to integrate some of their products, the potential was even greater than what I originally envisaged. So, there was Autodesk, and I can't remember the other two companies you might do.
I don't know the space intimately, but I just remember that Autodesk was one of them. As I believe from memory, they are the company that has the highest revenue per employee. And it's in the region of, I saw a graph recently, about $650,000 they generate per employee. It's remarkable. It's a phenomenally profitable and successful company.
Yeah, and incredibly smart people there
yeah.
as well. Mm. What's interesting is that they're very diverse across not just the M&E, but of course the construction and design space as well. And I think, you know, watch the space, but there could be some really interesting cross-pollinations that occur between that as well.
Mm-hmm. And so the pitch was invest your money with us, with Moxion. This is the vision. We intend to 10x the investment that you make. Sell within, I think it was 6 years or yep. 8 years, something in that sort of region.
Yeah.
And it'll be one of these three companies that that buy us. So what I'm hearing you say is that it was your knowledge of the space and your awareness of the problem that you were solving for that meant that you could have the certainty or at least the confidence to be able to turn up. And a lot of it is about confidence in business and especially in the fundraising space as well. There's another story that I came across, my researchers came across before this conversation, and it was you doing the hard yards in LA, as most startup founders have to do somewhere, sometime, whether it's LA or whether it's Auckland or whether it's Moscow. But you were really doing the hard yards there, and you were struggling to get a break.
Mm.
And I understand that there was a particular producer that you wanted to be able to get exposure to and get some endorsement from. Can you tell us about that kind of conversation? This is, you know, before the exit. We'll come back to the exit in a second, but I'm just curious about one of those. It sounded like it was one of those pivotal moments in the growth of the company. So bring that to life for us, if you could.
Yeah. So we started to do fairly well in Australasia. And part of it was, and just, you know, I think a huge thanks to the New Zealand film community and also the New Zealand investors. So the great thing about New Zealand is that they're kind of, the film industry and the investors here are very much like the parents you want to have. They're hard on you, but incredibly honest and incredibly nurturing, right? And so we would get feedback from the film industry and what we were building very quickly. And, you know, if you weren't doing great, they'd tell you. And we could get access to these people that you wouldn't normally be able to get access to in the US, especially as we were, you know, relatively unknown. And so on the back of that, we raised money and we went up to the US going, well, it's working in Australasia, it's just going to be a slam dunk here, right? And, yeah, there was a bit of a it didn't work out like that.
Reality hit you in the face.
Reality certainly came calling. And I think the reason for that was that we didn't have the contacts there that we had in New Zealand. We kind of had contacts, but also, you know, here's this crazy wide-eyed Kiwi that's turned up on your door. You're a big US studio, and I'm telling you how to make movies. It's like, whoa, really? You know? And the interesting thing about LA is that no one ever says no. Right, they just stop calling you or they block your calls, right? So you come out of every meeting going, hey, I think that we're really onto something here, and then you never hear from them again. So it was a very tough time. It was very disheartening. And, you know, I'm very stubborn. I don't like giving up, but I was probably as close to giving up as I've ever been in my life. And then we got a little bit of a break. There was a producer, and they said, you've got to meet this person. He's really kind of dialed into your space. He will get it, right? And that was kind of the other problem too, is that a lot of the people I was meeting, although they could, I think, see the efficiencies of what we could do in terms of film production, it wasn't really going to affect them. They were kind of in the middle management area, and worst case, it was a success, but they wouldn't reap any benefits from it. But the downside was massive. If we, you know, delayed their movie or broke their movie, they wouldn't work again. So it was very hard to meet someone at the right level that could A, understand it, and B, have it was very hard to meet someone who was at the right level and also had the autonomy to take the risk. You know, had they were the senior enough to do that. And so I heard of a producer and they said, I'll tell you where they are. They were working on a Harvey Weinstein movie. And they said, but you've got to get on and meet them yourself. So luckily I had some contacts with the security guards on the lot. They let me on, pointed me to where the trailer was. And I think I actually had a clipboard, because, you know, the old...
So important, yeah.
Yeah, got a
white coat and a clipboard, get him anywhere.
And I remember going and knocking on the trailer door, and he answered the door and said, and you are? And I went, hey, I'm Hugh, and I'm hustling. and bless him, he said, okay, come on in. And sat me down, and I think he said, look, you got 2 minutes. And I looked over and I saw on the inside of the door, which had closed, that he had like this this number written. I think it was 6 on US letter. And I said, what's that? And he said, oh, that's the number of days I've got left on the shoot. And I said, is it not going well? And he's going, let me tell you, it's going so bad I'm thinking, who's I got to screw to get off this shoot, right? So I had a whole setup of this product that we had, and I basically dialed them in and gave them the ability to see what was shooting on a set in New Zealand within about 90 seconds of the camera turning off. So sitting in his trailer, we could see what had been shot on another set on the other side of the world, and he went, wow, this is going to change things. And he said, I'm probably going to into therapy after this, so I'm not in the right space, but you should meet Barry Osborne.
Yes.
And so through that, Barry was actually back in New Zealand shooting a movie, and I went and met him. And I think probably there were a few people that absolutely changed the trajectory of where we're going. One of them would have been Rudy.
Yes, Rudy Burblitz from Flying Kiwis, just for the record.
Who was just one of the greatest mentors and supporters that I've had. Another one would have been Barry Osborne.
Yeah, amazing.
And he had more fortitude and foresight than probably I did of the product. Mm. There were times where I think I turned up at a studio one time with a bottle of wine and said, look, thanks so much for trying to get me on this gig. You know, appreciate everything you've done. And he would go, oh, no, don't give up now.
You know, we're just getting warmed up.
Well, yeah, and he was absolutely right. He was going, well, have you thought about this? Have you thought about that? And just someone with that level of, I think, character and experience is such an asset for a fledgling startup.
Yeah, no doubt.
Because, you know, also you're growing so quickly. You know, over a few years you've done the equivalent of going from crawling to walking. You're like a baby, then you're an adult. And there aren't many people that can go through that very fast transition with you. Yeah. And he was one of them, and Rudy was another. And I think that's something too that I've learned. I'm being very tangential here, but sure. You know, as if I went back and sort of gave myself some advice, it's okay to let people go through that process, because they have done what was right for that stage, and they might not be right for earlier, and they wouldn't have been right for earlier. Mm. I've let people go who. And it's okay to do that, because they weren't right for where you are now, but they were just perfect for that moment you needed them.
Yeah, it's been said that people come into your life for a reason, a season, or a lifetime.
Mm.
And the trick is to figure out which of those that person, that relationship is. You've also talked quite deeply there about mentorship and getting advice and guidance from folk that have been there. They may not have been there, but they may have a different perspective to you, and they understand where you're at. But people that can support, encourage, cajole, kick you in the butt occasionally, you know, all those sorts of things are invaluable. I'd like to jump onto the exit with Autodesk, if I can.
Mm. Yes, of course.
So talk me through kind of the key timelines. So that the company was officially sold in 2022.
Mm.
It was kind of mid to late 2022, recollection. So let's go back to when the prospect of the deal rose its head, and then what were some key milestones from there, and then we'll kind of unpick each of those threads as we go.
Yeah, of course. So it was a really interesting time for us, because we had got onto a series called Rings of Power.
It's the Lord of the Rings series, is that series?
Yeah. Which was, I think, and might still be the biggest TV series ever made.
Okay, wow.
And then COVID hit, right? And we saw probably 80% of our productions just disappear.
Wow.
And that was another of, we think this might be over moments.
Mm.
And then what happened is that a lot of the people who we had spoken to previously, and they knew about our product, but they hadn't engaged with us, started calling. But they'd figured out our product was really the only way for them to keep shooting and maintain these little bubbles that were springing up because of the immediacy of what we could do. And so we went from, you know, thinking to we're going to shut up shop to doubling, tripling revenue and employees over like 6 to 8 months. And suddenly we were on all these you know, huge movies like, you know, Jurassic World and the Matrix reboot and the Batman and Rings of Power, the TV series.
Incredible.
And two very, very progressive people that were on there, Ron Ames, really understood, again, you know, this happens to me, people seem to understand what I'm doing even better than I do and take it into new areas. So if that happens, run with it, you know. Another person called Jesse. And they really championed us with Autodesk because we had integrated with one of their products called ShotGrid. And I think there was just this synergy there that really, really helped progress this incredibly ambitious TV series. That they were trying to do an absolutely outrageous number of visual effects shots, and there's no way they could do it by brute force. They just had to be clever. And so they were building all these systems, and out of necessity, they really helped us advance our integration with the Autodesk ShotGrid. And that way we got to know the Autodesk team very well, and it just kind of made sense. And that was an interesting time in us too, because...
So we're 2021 kind of phase by
now? Yeah, yeah. And we were growing. We really needed to decide, do we do a Series A? Our competitors in the US had done a Series A. And unfortunately... Or fortunately, actually, and I think this is one of the things about the New Zealand startup scene is that we've been quite heavily diluted. So if we were going to do a Series A, we were probably going to find it hard to get venture capital or private equity involved, because when you get founders down to that low level, they, you know, quite rightly, I think, see that they're going to lose a lot of their enthusiasm.
Yeah, influence, I think, is the key thing, because the risk and the return is not as great. Do you mind me asking, at that stage, because there was you and a co-founder,
yes.
What kind of percentage points of equity were you sitting on at that stage?
Oh, I think we were a sub-10.
Sub-10?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
Wow. And they really wanted us around 60, right? 60, 65. Mm. And, you know, the New Zealand ecosystem has changed massively since then. Mm. Because what happens is, if you get down to that level, then it's hard to progress, and you probably have to have like a, you know, how are we going to do this discussion with the shareholders, who you don't want to do that, right? And also, like, our shareholders were just great, you know, our investors were amazing, you know, it wasn't their fault, it was not their fault that we were naive enough to let that happen, right?
Yeah,
You know, I can't thank them enough, because I wouldn't be sitting here having this fun conversation with you without them. And actually, I've got a little story about some of these amazing shareholders. I'll tell it later. So we were trying to figure out what to do, and there were a few options open to us, but doing a Series A was probably not the way we're going to go forward. And there were other companies who just wanted to buy us outright, and we just, it just made sense with Autodesk. They had a vision which none of the other people who were interested in us had, and they kind of got us as well, and we got them. I feel like I'm going to say they completed us.
I think it's appropriate given the business that you're in.
Yeah.
Let me just recap a couple of things and just pick up on a couple of additional questions. So you had already done some work and were working alongside Autodesk, the software that they had in the adjacent space. You then had some introductions from some kind of formative key people to more senior folk in Autodesk. Yeah. So you got elevated inside the organization. So in other words, they started to...
If you like, I can say this again in a more concise way.
No, it's all good. Okay. No, okay. We're good. And then they, as a consequence, became more interested in you as a business and as a proposition. And so then how did you flip from being we're a prospective real partner. Mm. And, oh, by the way, in the background, we need money. You're thinking about that. How did you flip that conversation into being a potential acquisition conversation? Did you have a third party investment banker involved, some advisors or something that were there working on your behalf? Or was it just a natural segue, or did they ask you? I'm curious about that piece.
Yeah. So we were thinking about doing a Series A, and I think we looked at them first as a possible lead investor in a Series A.
Got it.
And then so we engaged with them around that.
They've got a ventures division, right?
Yeah, exactly. And we just started talking from that angle. Then I think at some point we kind of heard that they weren't interested in investing. And we went, oh, well, that's a shame. But very quickly it was followed by, we would like to acquire you.
Right.
You know, and, you know, let's look at what that would take.
And at that point, you were thinking about raising money, not about selling the business. So what did that do to your mentality, your psyche? Were you like blown away and this is incredible? Or were you more like, oh, it's too soon? Or where did you go?
I'm just trying to remember back in that space. Because we're incredibly busy as well, right?
Yes, yeah.
And so I think part of me went, this makes a lot of sense. Are we at the right stage, you know, for this? And the more we learned about them, the more we engaged with them, it really seemed that this was a great next step, because the rapid growth that we wanted to do, we were probably going to have to align with them anyway, right? Because they were such major players in the industry. So I think just having, you know, being part of their company just made a lot of sense. And also I think raising money, doing these rounds, it's really distracting. It's so distracting. Mm. And, you know, we didn't want to slow the growth. And to your question, I remember opening up, we created the DD room, and I think there were probably four or five of us in there, and then we invited them, and suddenly there were like 120.
Wow.
Or something like that. It was pretty high numbers. And I remember going, this is a scale way beyond what we do.
More than the staff that you had in totality.
Oh,
right?
I think we only had sort of, I don't know, 15 staff.
Oh, you peaked at 15.
15, 20, 20, maybe 20. Yeah, okay. We had a whole lot of contractors actually.
Yes.
Because when you grow quickly, it's easier to bring contractors on board. Mm. But you know, they do this often. We were in very good hands.
Yeah. A pretty slick M&A process and team, both of which they can help because they navigate the conversation in a way that like is logical and it makes sense.
Yeah.
But also it can be quite intimidating, right? Because it was the first time you'd been through that process before.
Yes.
And did you? Who was on your side? You know, lawyers, advisors, accountants, whoever was.
Yeah. So we had lawyers, accountants on our side, and we had a person from the SaaS space who had experience in Silicon Valley, a guy called Pooj, who was amazing at just making sure that we had our act together, right? Because they move at such speed and there are so many of them that you really don't want for them to be waiting on you. If anything, you want it to be the other way around.
Time kills deals, and so you might want to make sure that you get through this stuff swiftly and appear to be the organized company you hope to appear to be.
Exactly. Yeah. And you know, and we were lucky because when we were pre-meeting Rudy, we didn't have any proper structures, any documents, any proper minutes at board meetings or any kind of anything like that. But once Rudy came on the board, all that changed. Yeah. So, you know, I mean that's something is if I have to give an advice to a startup is prepare yourself for exit from the very, very beginning. Mm-hmm. Because that's going to ensure you have the right systems in place, the right processes, the right board members, all the information that you do not want to be scrambling around to try and create when you are at the point of success.
Yeah, 100%. You know? I call it the hygiene factors, which oversimplifies and dumbs it down. A lot of it is actually around the just the organization rather than necessarily the deep thought or the intelligence. So it's more just about having the discipline and the follow through for that stuff. Mm. Some of it is definitely around thinking and having the right systems and the right advisors in place, especially the board related activity. But making sure you've got effective reporting and thorough reporting that's all in the same place and it's consistent, it's just good discipline, right?
Yeah.
So they jumped into due diligence.
Yeah.
They were pouring through. There was 100-odd people from their side that were going through everything that was sitting inside the data room. And you mentioned that there had been others that were potentially interested as well. So you were able to develop a little bit of deal tension leading up to that stage?
Yeah. Because, I mean, what you do is you sign an agreement that you are exclusive. Up to a point in time, and then you need to keep them informed about any other interest that is coming through. So you can use that to apply some tension. You can say, well, you know, someone just reached out to see if we were available.
Yes.
But obviously you can't say who that person was or anything like that.
It's kind of like dating, right?
Yeah.
So I'm out in the dating pool. I'm still on Tinder. You know, I'm still available because nobody's locked this down yet. But I'm really interested in you. So we're kind of exclusive, but not really kind of thing. So it's kind of like that dance, isn't it?
Yeah. You just can't swipe.
Yes.
If you swipe, you get in a lot of trouble.
Right, yes.
You can just talk about how you could potentially swipe.
Right.
Yeah.
Yes. Got it. So... at what stage did you move from exclusive conversation to letter of intent, presuming that was the process that you went through, which is quite a North American approach?
Yeah, it was fairly rapid, I think. I from memory, it was in the weeks, not months.
Wow, okay.
And then you get the letter of intent and then you're locked in.
Yes.
And you go away and you really do the work.
Yes.
You know, you have, you know, interviews and questions and... Yeah, there's a huge amount of coverage of every facet of your business.
Yes.
And again, that's where Pooj really helped.
Yeah.
You know, he was a buffer. He was like foreshadowing what was going to come up, making sure that we had that, giving us coaching on, you know, how to present, how to I guess answer these questions that you'd never been asked before.
Mm. Yeah, it's invaluable.
So, you know, it's somewhat easy once you know, but not knowing, it's just so hard.
Yeah, you know? I get that. So letter of intent turned up, you go into deep DD. Mm-hmm. Approximately what was the duration between the LOI and the DD process and then the deal being done? That's the first half of the question.
Yeah.
The second half is, was there any market changes from what was encapsulated on the letter of intent and then the ultimate deal that got done?
No, not. I think it got extended a couple of times.
Okay.
So I think that it was meant to be wrapped up before Christmas.
Okay.
And
which would have been about 4 or 5 months after.
Yeah,
the
maybe
LOI.
3 months. I have
three
in my head.
Yep.
And then we got extended out a couple of times. Just, you know, a mutual agreement.
Yep.
We needed to dig deeper into some areas. Mm-hmm. And you know, I think also because we were a New Zealand company, there were quite a few differences in terms of just some legalese, the structure, that kind of stuff, which we had to get our head around. You know, I think American companies are really interested in just buying the IP, whereas we really wanted the whole company to be sold. So just sort of figuring out the different approaches that could be taken and aligning on that.
Yeah.
And then it was done. And I remember it was actually, I think, 3 a.m. And I was in Nelson. I was exhausted, and there was the I can't even remember the name, but it's called the deal closure call or whatever it is,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah.
Where they're about to transfer, you know, tens of millions of dollars,
mm-hmm.
To a bank account.
Yes.
And you get to say yes.
Mm.
And I remember like waking up. It was sort of cold in the morning and jumping on this call, and it was just surreal. There was, you know, our lawyer, their lawyer, and then at one point they said, you know, have there been any material changes in the last 24 hours? And we said no. And then they said, are you okay to release the funds? And my lawyer turned to me and said, are we okay to release these funds? And I think I perhaps, you know, release the hounds.
How apt. If only that had been filmed, that would have been great for posterity.
Yeah. And then it was done. And I remember going back to bed and you know, crawling beside my wife and starting to cry because my whole life had changed in that moment.
Mm.
And it had been such a ride that I hadn't really processed it until that, you know, 2:30 in the morning in Nelson.
Yes.
Just sitting there going, wow.
Yeah, wow. If you don't mind me asking, I'm guessing that the overwhelming of emotions was a lot of tension had been built up over that time, and you end up with a lot of uncertainty as you're going through that process. And so you get to the stage of it all being kind of, you know, realised and it's actually going to happen and, you know, we're going to do this deal. I'm really curious as to whether at that stage or subsequent to that you had any turmoil or any upset because this was your baby. You know, Moxion had Hugh stamped all over it. You'd made a lot of sacrifices to grow that company. You'd moved countries with the family. Mm. You'd dealt with the hardship of growing a business. You had a year of really, really difficult times in LA. So, you know, they say that one of the hardest parts of selling a business, and I've had this experience with my first company, is the separation anxiety, and they call it founder's remorse. Yeah. Do you think any of that overwhelming nature at that time could have been for that, or was it just the things that we've spoken about?
It really was just, I think, the weight of responsibility of having all these amazing investors who had trusted me. So I'd gone and stood before them and sold what I thought I could do to them, and they'd given me money. And just that sense of responsibility. I also had family money in there as well. But my uncle David was a very instrumental part of the process as well. He came in and pretty much saved our company early on with an investment before we had any a real angel investment.
Yeah.
And it got us to being able to have that angel investment. Yeah, I mean, I think it was, you know, I think a little bit of, you know, your child's leaving home.
Yes.
For the first time. Will it come back, and will it ever be the same?
Mm.
But I think just really doing right by our investors was kind of the emotion, and also by the family as well, because I'd put them through a whole lot.
Yeah.
You know, my she's now 11. But I hadn't seen her, you know, a lot of the times, and you know, the whole sale process had really exacerbated that too, because you have to keep selling, right? So you know, I was in charge of sales as well as everything else as a CEO.
Mm.
You have to make those numbers, right? Because the deal pivots around you making the numbers that you said you would, right? So you still got to keep closing them, plus you have all the pressures of the deal as well. And I remember her coming into me and I was in the room and I was on a Zoom call and I was pushed her away and she came in later and said, "Daddy, do you still love me?" And I just went, "Look, sweetheart, I love you. This is just a really, really important part of my life. I need to get it right. I will so make it up to you." And then she said, "What will you do, Daddy?" And I said, "I'm going to take you to Hogwarts." And she went,
"To Hogwarts?"
Hogwarts, yeah.
That's a restaurant, a cafe? No, it's a place in...
Harry Potter,
yes,
come on.
Yes, okay, yeah. Got it. Okay, cool. Yeah.
I'm going to take you to Hogwarts. And she was just getting into Harry Potter then and her eyes widened and she went, "Okay."
Have you taken her?
Yes, I took her to Universal Studios in Orlando.
Amazing.
And we spent a week there.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that was one of the first trips I booked after we'd closed.
Yes. So talk me through a couple of things. So I'm guessing that the reason that you were acquired ultimately was because you slotted into a great part of the portfolio of products that Autodesk had. But if you could just clarify that a little more. And then I'm also curious as to what the mechanism for valuing the company was. So yeah, why did they buy you and how did they value you?
So we slotted quite well into Autodesk's existing tool set because they were primarily in post-production and we were on set production. And so a lot of the footage and the metadata that we were acquiring, they needed further down the chain. And so I guess our acquisition got them closer to the source, the wellspring of this, both metadata and data in terms of the visuals and that kind of stuff. One of the things that they were doing and are doing now, they're creating this platform for production, which is called Flow. And I could really see how we could help that as well. And a lot of this is about interoperability, which is kind of the bane of a lot of film productions, is that you process something somewhere and then you have to move the data and the metadata to something else and then to something else. And their vision of Flow really is about bringing the tools to the data rather than the other way around. And that's valuable for so many reasons.
Yes.
You know, security, just the ability to have consistency of product and interface and all this kind of stuff. In an industry where it's so fast turnaround, it's a bit like a startup. Every production, I think, every movie production is a bit like a startup. You know, you just start to figure out how to make things work and then it's all over, right?
And makes sense in terms of why that would be what I would consider to be like a strategic acquisition, because it makes sense across the portfolio of things that they have. It also increases their presence and position in the clients that they work with, and they could no doubt kind of cross-sell, upsell, and then kind of, you know, work alongside the other things that they were doing. So how did they value the business, and what was the mechanism that was used to get to that number?
Yeah, so it was a combination of revenue and strategic alignment or value. Mm-hmm. Also this was around COVID, so valuations were fairly high then.
Yep.
We got over a 20 times revenue valuation.
Incredible.
From them. Mm. But you know, that's what companies were going for around that time.
Yes.
I think also there was a appreciation of keeping the team here. Yes. As well. Mm. Which was another, you know, if you flip it around, that was what we saw was the value that they brought above just the money. Was they really seemed to understand our team and wanted to nurture them. So that was another big tick in the box for why we went with them.
Yeah, great. And you've stayed on since then. It's been a couple of years now, hasn't it?
Coming up 3 years almost. Wow. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Mm. So in November, I think. Yeah.
The deal was structured that was cash up front, I believe. There wasn't a long earnout for you and your co-founder.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, there was some retention, just for myself and Michael, my co-founder.
Yes.
Okay. But I think what was important to us was all the shareholders were pretty much after a year. Yes. It was all distributed.
Yeah, and my recollection, being an investor, just for disclaimer's sakes, is that it was 80%, I think, or 90% up front, cash. This is for the investors and a chunk of yours in that as well. And then it was about a year long of retention, and it was a relatively small proportion. So it was a generous deal. It was a good deal.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, like we mentioned earlier, they've done this before. They're a firm hand on the investment tiller.
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm. So I think we've talked about the how they valued the company. I'm curious now about the journey of the exit specifically, so that kind of 12-18 month period or so, and maybe post handing over the keys as well. If you look back upon that, if there was anything that you would do differently knowing now what you know now,
In terms of the whole Moxium process, or just
the deal process?
Oh, the deal process.
Yeah.
I think just a lot more prep, you know?
Right.
I mean, the questions that they asked were very, very, very fair and relevant questions.
Yes.
I think if we had just done even more prep for that, then it would have been smoother. I wouldn't have been kicking my daughter out of the room. But I mean, you know, you don't know it until you've done it.
That's right.
It was just this, you know, huge amounts of learning, and just being in those conversations with, you know, these top American law firms whose bread and butter is doing these acquisitions.
Yes.
All these terms and little things. Would I've done it differently? You know what? Probably not.
Right.
Because I wouldn't have gone away and learned all this stuff because
You're
so busy anyway. I wouldn't have had capacity to do it. I think it probably happened at the right time.
Yeah.
Maybe a little bit more rigor around our board notes and stuff like that from the early days. But that certainly started to come with Rudy and also Garth, who came on as well.
Yes, that's right.
I think maybe sort of the early stuff we could have cleaned up a little.
Yeah, okay.
Because we had to do it fast.
Yes.
And, you know, it was a lot of, it was all there, but we just had to go through emails and reconstruct it. As part of that.
And that takes time, which has some potential threats and risk around the deal itself.
Yeah.
So what I've heard you say is that preparedness is super important, even if you don't know when necessarily it's going to happen. And then having folk that are around you that have walked that path historically and kind of know the things to look out for and can give you some coaching around some of those crucial conversations that happen. That's in terms of the deal process. Of course, along the way, what we haven't talked about is building a wonderful product that met a real need and solved a critical problem. And you mentioned at the very start of this conversation, the timing of bringing that to market was just bang on because, you know, cloud computing was becoming ubiquitous and people were probably quite frustrated with the journey. And then, of course, there was all of the production houses that started to pour, you know, billions of dollars into new productions, which had quite a tectonic shift, I understand, on the whole industry as well. And so a number of factors that led to that being successful. So I've got one last question for you, Hugh, and it's the alternative universe question. And so in this universe, you didn't head down the path of becoming a software engineer and then moving into space before the movies, then moving into the movie business and, you know, transporting cadavers covered in vampire blood around the place and then, of course, starting a software company. But in the world where you would have done a different career, one that you have perhaps looked upon from time to time and thought, that looks like a really satisfying and rewarding career, what could that have been?
I think I would have liked to have been a scriptwriter. Or a writer.
Yeah, well.
I love stories. Mm-hmm. I love the power they have to connect and change people.
Yes.
And I think, you know, what we've really talked about here is a bit of a story too.
Yes.
I think it's an area that's always fascinated me. It's just how words on a piece of paper can transport you.
Yes.
You know, maybe it's not too late.
Well, they'd say old dog, new tricks. I'm a big fan of Andrew Huberman. I'm not sure if you've come across his work, Huberman Labs. And so he makes science accessible for everybody. And so he talks about connecting up neural pathways in your brain. And you're actually never too old to do it. And so you can do it into your literally into your 80s. Takes a little bit more effort and there's a bit more process and repetition of things to make sure those things stick. But I know you've got some writing skills anyway, and so, you know, perhaps it may never be too late to have another alternate second career.
Who knows?
Yeah, who knows? Exactly.
I might be sitting here again.
That's right. But another exit of selling you mentioned that a movie is like a startup anyway.
Yeah.
So there you go. Hugh, it's been a really insightful conversation. I've learned a lot today, not the least of which is how to pronounce your surname, Hugh Carvley. I've got it right the second time. So there's been some gold in there about raising money, about building a startup, about tenacity, about how to navigate your way through a deal process. So I'm really grateful for you turning up and joining us on the show, and I'm really grateful for my fancy new stripy socks. So
they'll suit you, I can tell already.
Already, I've got a pair on here, some stripes.
Yeah,
So thank you, sir. Thanks for coming on, Hugh.
Oh, my absolute pleasure.